Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. Hello.
Gigi, the path out is becoming clearer. On Friday, the Prime Minister will tell us about that early mark, what the premiers and he have decided about a return to something closer to normal. Also on Friday, the Reserve Bank will release the first set of official forecasts for the recovery. These are quarter-by-quarter readings of business investment, housing investment, imports, exports, wages, employment, economic growth. We haven't had a set since February, and I can tell you I've just had a look at the set in at the beginning of February, and there was no downturn forecast then, let alone a recovery. The Treasurer said this week that economic activity, GDP, call it what you like, would shrink 10% during this quarter, the one we're in. But what about that recovery? They were saying it would be V-shaped. then they said it would be exactly. Then they said it would be U-shaped. Now I'm reading about a wheelbarrow shape, which I think means it goes down and then just stays down. It raises a broader question that we're going to look at today. What will things be like when this is over? Let's go a year into the future. Later we'll talk to former government advisor Ross Garnaut about the likely transformation of energy and industry. But first, some easy guesses. A year after this is over, I've got a few. I think the cruise industry is finished, pretty much. I think the postal service will never return to what it was, and nor should it. We don't need daily letter deliveries. I'm not sure people will go to the movies.
Oh, anymore. Peter, they will go to the movies. Come on.
Oh, I'm not going to for a while.
Oh, look, no, performing arts and dying out. No, everybody, it will come back eventually as the hysteria wanes and we get our perspective back. I mean, who doesn't love going out on dates? For a dinner and a movie. It's human.
And a dinner, I can understand.
No, the virus.
Cafes, I'm looking forward to that.
Viruses are not going to stop people from being social animals eventually. And the government can help us along that return to normal life by providing a bit of perspective, right? We've seen a bit of perspective provided in some of the recent coverage. Like, did you see Ross Gittin's latest pieces? And one of them, he said, the recession the medicos said we need to have, right? And in The Australian, there was a series of articles by Adam Creighton. And there was an op-ed by Henry Urgas and Jonathan Pincus pointing out the trade-offs that our policymakers seem to have collectively missed until recently. So no, I think there definitely will be a return to normal and the government should be hastening that along as much as possible.
Right.
I definitely plan to go to the movies.
All right, how normal won't it be? What will have changed?
Well, so this is exactly the question, and we've never been in this situation before. We don't know for sure, but there is a lot of talk about particular technologies and ways of working that might stick because we've stumbled into them or we've had to do them during this period, and we've realized, hey, that actually works pretty well. So,
you know, like working from home.
Well, possibly.
For a lot of people.
For some people.
That is now possible. Now,
mm-hmm.
Psychologists are said to say you develop neural pathways, new ones, after about 8 weeks, and we will have had that. Working at home.
Mm-hmm.
What seemed impossible for most people will now seem possible for quite a few of them. So, and think of the implications for that. Perhaps fewer large office buildings or office buildings that aren't as big. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we've learned to do online shopping centres. Gee, I wouldn't like to be owning a shopping centre.
Oh, look, shopping centres were already a declining industry before COVID-19, far before COVID-19. And I think, you know, the death knells are well and truly ringing out at this stage for them. But I don't think that all of this working from home stuff is going to stick. I mean, we're going to be talking to someone who's authored a paper exactly on this question a bit later in the show. But first of all, not all occupations can work from home. We know that. And secondly, even for the ones who can, there's going to be an urge to be back together, cheek by jowl, with people in charge as soon as it's possible to do so, right? I mean, if you're at home and you're not able to have a quiet word with the boss at the water cooler about, you know, that promotion you wanted, it's just not as effective, right? So I think the people's desire to get ahead and be part of the action is going to drive them back into offices.
On the other hand, people may well never fully return to the office in
possibly
a lot of
not
in
possibly
five
not.
Days a week.
But I hope the productivity levels will come up because that's one thing I would expect to see in the economic figures coming out eventually when we get them is that labor productivity will have tanked during this period because not only are we being forced to use a technology that might not be optimal for all the activities we need to do, but a lot of people have got small kids running around underfoot. And that's just, we all know, everybody who's been a parent knows that's going to kill your productivity.
I saw a fascinating paper just this week on the productivity of economists. Sorry to talk in-house, but people writing working papers, right? And according to this paper published by the National Bureau of Economic Research, the productivity of male economists while being at home has shot up by the number of working papers. Not so much the females.
Yeah, because guess who's looking after the kids? Yeah.
This was the suggestion. Mm-hmm. Assume that immigration, the borders are closed for a long time, and Labor's been talking about reassessing Australia's rate of immigration. Mm-hmm. We take in more than a quarter of a million net terms. Australians leave and foreigners come in. In net terms, we take in more than a quarter of a million people per year. Foreign students, around 800,000, even more. So without those things, I'll tell you what, I think we're not going to do. Mm. We're not going to be building new university buildings. Why would you? You don't know what you're going to be building. We'd be unlikely to build new offices. We would have much less need, whether we still need to do them or not, for the freeways, the light rail being built in Sydney or Melbourne. We would be getting what a lot of people have always said they wanted, which is a zero state economy. And I don't think it'll be as pleasant as they think either.
Well, I definitely think that the industries like higher education, high school, secondary education market, the TAFE market, that will be affected by fewer students wanting to undertake the adventure of coming to Australia, even if borders do open and there's a quarantine restriction for 2 weeks. If they compare that to what's on offer from other countries, they may find that Australia isn't as attractive after all. On the other hand, I've heard, as I, you know, work in the university sector, that it's possible that the United States is looking pretty bad at the moment in terms of levels of infections and, you know, danger, 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 maybe ringing in the ears of some of the students' parents. So actually, by contrast, Australia might look a bit better. So if there's a, you know, swath of Chinese parents who are looking to send their kids overseas to some English language speaking country, Australia might actually get lucky yet again and look good relative to the UK or the United States. Because if in COVID-19 terms, those two latter countries look like a more dangerous place than Australia.
We always seem to have got lucky, at least for the last 100 years, one way or another, with one thing and another. And we'll speak with a guest who's actually written a paper on this for Deloitte Access Economics. The subtitle was, "The Future of Work Isn't Scary, It's Just Misunderstood." I think the picture is that we'll be working in the same way as before. We'll have many of the same industries as before. Perhaps the arts industry will take a big dive for a while before we can have concerts and so on. It's just that there'll be less of it, less people, fewer people, and less construction.
Fewer
which
buildings.
Means yeah. Fewer construction workers. We have a million people
absolutely
doing that, right?
Absolutely.
A tenth of our workforce does that. And I can't see
a lot of
the need for that. Lower house prices,
exactly. I mean, this is something we've been talking about for how many years? The crazy housing market in Australian cities and how expensive everything has gotten. I mean, maybe that's another positive silver lining out of all of this, is that maybe we'll start to see a decline in some of those housing values. So the young people who are, in some sense, getting the thin edge of the wedge at the moment might benefit down the track in 5 years and be able to afford a house.
Or maybe not, because the housing values have been highest near the water. And those suburbs have been going up because they're rare, you know, and they'll still be rare.
That's true for any big city that's, you know, got a particularly prime spot that has scarce land. You know, San Francisco has the same problem.
I'll make a prediction that even with much lower immigration, if that's what we have, there will still be pressure on house prices. What will ease that pressure is effectively lower wages. We're having people being told to take pay cuts of 20% or told to work 4 days a week. If that continues, that will put pressure on prices. You're listening to The Economist on Radio National with me, Peter Martin, Gigi Foster, working out what things will look like on the other side.
Joining us now is Jessica Mizrahi, an associate director of Deloitte Access Economics, who is the co-author of a report entitled The Path to Prosperity, Why the Future of Work is Human. Jess, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Gigi.
Thanks.
So Jess, in the Path to Prosperity report, you said that you don't expect to see a big increase in the number of people working from home. This was, of course, published before COVID-19. It was only about 4%, your prediction at the time. Do you think you guys got that wrong in light of this incredible new information we've had in the past few months?
I will say that no one predicts the Spanish Inquisition and no one predicts the coronavirus.
No one.
So, look, the 4% figure actually referred to census day back when census was done. But it does seem that people want their flexibility flexibly. One in five employers on average offer Australians the ability to work from home flexibly. Roughly one quarter of Australians are doing it at least sometimes. But the trick is that very few have formal work from home arrangements. Now, obviously, that's changed very rapidly in recent weeks, as the vast majority of Australia's white-collar workforce has started to work from home. And employers who have previously said that it was a no-go, I think that position will become increasingly difficult to hold. But as you said earlier, Gigi, there are definite benefits from being in the office. I know how much I miss my colleagues. I do think that people will return to the offices and they will return in some ways to normal. But whether that is to the same level that we have seen previously, wait and see.
So which kinds of occupations do you think will be more or less affected by this? Because we hear a lot about working from home, but it's kind of, we're all in this bubble, we being, you know, people who actually have a voice during this crisis. But there's a vast swath of Australians who cannot do their work from home. Which occupations do you think are likely to hang on to those habits, those new habits, once the COVID-19 crisis lifts?
That's an interesting question because it's very easy to talk about the white-collar workers. Most of our largest employing industries are quite reliant on face-to-face contact. Healthcare and social assistance, retail, construction, education, you're seeing some of them adapt really very quickly. So in healthcare, for example, we're seeing the government rolling out Medicare benefits for GPs to do telehealth. And where services like that are able to stay, then perhaps we will see an increase in the number of people who are able to work remotely. However, in industries like construction, for example, of course you can't build a building remotely. So there will be some differences we see across industries.
So what do you think is going to happen to an often overlooked sector, but a vitally important one for long-run growth, entrepreneurship?
You know, there's an old saying that necessity is the mother of all invention, and perhaps unemployment is the gateway to entrepreneurship.
Could this be right, that we will see more people starting their own businesses?
Absolutely. And I think that there's so much potential in that. You know, we see in countries which have experienced a recession more recently than Australia, for example, the GSE, if we look over to the US, there's a young immigrant who was unemployed in California. He had great tech skills. He applied for a bunch of jobs, including at Facebook. He was rejected. He started a company. 5 years later, WhatsApp was acquired by Facebook, the company who had, in fact, rejected that employee for $19 billion. And there's so many stories just like WhatsApp's story.
Can I sketch out another almost opposite scenario, which is that buying of clothes has been way down because you don't need them below the waist, really, when you're remote. And that in this time, people may have had to become less consumerist. I am wondering whether people becoming less consumerist because they've learnt to do so, we might have less people actually prepared or even seeing the need to spend their money.
There is definitely truth to that.
But I mean, surely this is not something that's going to last that much beyond the actual recessionary period. I mean, it's lovely to have this utopian vision that people are going to become less consumerist in general. But do you really see that sticking beyond, you know, when GDP really starts to pick up again?
I don't personally think so. I do think that as our confidence rebounds, so too do our belts loosen and our wallets loosen along with our belts. Perhaps with Australia having in general quite high rates of debt and Australians being quite willing to borrow, maybe for some people this is a good time to think about their financial literacy, to make sure that they have a good understanding of their finances and our ability to be financially resilient as individuals, as households and as a society. I don't think that that would be a bad thing for more people to consider.
Mm-hmm. This is The Economist on Radio National with me, Gigi Foster, Peter Martin, and Jessica Mizrahi on the future of what we'll do and how we'll do it when this is all over. So, Jess, I wanted to come back to the idea that maybe this recession could be, in some sense, a rebirth, and maybe, in a way, a cleansing of some of the ills that Australia's economy has suffered from in the recent past. So to correct some of the dysfunctions we've seen, there's a term in economics, which I'm sure you're familiar with, called creative destruction. The idea being that when we destroy some businesses in a recession, that some of that destruction may be creative in the sense that it, in fact, takes out, it purifies, if you will, some of the markets that really shouldn't have had those excess players in them, and causes the capital and labor that were previously used in those companies to be redeployed elsewhere where they're more productive. To what extent do you see that this coming recession may have some elements of that kind of creative destruction?
Australia, not that that's pleasant, by the way, for the people involved.
No, absolutely. And I don't think that that is something which should be taken lightly. You know, it's very easy to talk in a macro sense about business counts and numbers and employment, but behind every one of those things is a person. Behind every one of those is a dream of a business, and I don't think that we should ever forget that deeply human element. I will say, however, that creative destruction is not a new thing. In fact, Australia already has a fairly high rate of creative destruction. We only see four-year business survival rates are about 65%. So if you want to flip that on its head, it means that one-third of Australian businesses don't survive even 4 years. And that's without a recession.
So final question for you, Jess. In light of that likely suffering in certain areas of the economy and for certain businesses, is there a role for government? And if so, what kinds of industries do you see potentially being a good bet for the government coming out of this?
Government has a very important role. And indeed, it's easy to forget that government is actually the single largest employer in this entire country.
It also pays most Australians at the moment. It pays 6.6 million Australians through JobKeeper and another quarter of the workforce directly.
There we go. So let's not us forget the important role that our government plays. It doesn't necessarily have as immediate an effect as building a very fast train or spending more on the NBN. But by investing in our people, in our human capital and in our skills, as well as in our health system, I actually do think that we can lift the productive capacity of our economy going forward. Just making us smarter, making us healthier people, that has benefits which, while they may take longer to manifest, they really could bring long-term benefits to our economy. I think that the conversation about whether the government borrows or not is the less relevant conversation at the moment. We have interest rates at historic lows. Government has the capacity to borrow. And frankly, the best way to fix the budget is simply to help businesses, to help our economy get back on its feet so that we continue generating revenue. The question is, what is going to deliver the best benefit to our economy, both in the short term and in the long term? And then how do we best invest in those opportunities for the nation?
Jessica Mizrahi from Deloitte Access Economics, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Coming up, Ross Garnaut.
If we're to take advantage of that reality that the government will have to spend money big time to get us out of a slump, it'd make sense to spend money on something that was worthwhile anyway. Now, right at the centre of that debate a decade ago on climate change and industry was Professor Ross Garnaut. He conducted the 2008 Climate Change Review for the state and Commonwealth governments and the 2011 review for the Australian Parliament. What he found back then was that the benefits of a global effort to contain global temperature increases to 2 degrees would greatly exceed the costs eventually, but not at the time. Now, his return to that question a decade or so on and found something quite different. He says it took him a while to appreciate how different. Ross Garnaut joined us from Melbourne, where he's a professorial fellow at Melbourne University, to explain why.
Hello, Peter and Gigi.
Can you tell us first, how did you work out the costs and benefits of action to contain climate change back then? Indeed, what are the costs and the benefits?
Well, that was the most elaborate exercise in economic modelling of the Australian economy that's ever been done. And we had to assume certain changes in technology and costs of technologies. We drew upon the what was at the time the best possible advice, the people in business, but also working at the frontiers of technology in universities and research institutes in Australia, the US, Japan, Korea, China, Germany, Britain. We wrote all of that into the modelling. For example, the consultations led us to a presumption that for a decade or so, costs of solar technologies would fall by a few percent per annum. That was the costs of the transition. The benefits of being part of a global effort to remove greenhouse gases were the benefits of reduced damage from climate change. And so we did very elaborate modelling on the various impacts of unmitigated climate change. What would the costs be if nothing was done about the problem and temperature increases continued uncontrolled? And we identified from the science a large number of impacts. We commissioned research on particular impacts. One was bushfires from the CSIRO and Bureau of Meteorology, which has received some recent attention. We had a very good study done. What would happen to agricultural value in the Murray-Darling Basin with warming and drying? That showed with unmitigated climate change, if the world did nothing about it, then temperature increases and drying would lead to a 90% reduction in the value of irrigation output by late in the century. We looked at increased costs of infrastructure in a hotter environment, and in southern Australia, a drier one. We would have to build bigger dams, build stronger transmission lines for electricity to withstand more fierce cyclonic events. We would have to engineer our ports in a sturdier way. We would have to make coastal infrastructure immune to what was going to be quite a substantial sea level rise. The benefit of climate change mitigation, the benefit of reducing greenhouse emissions as part of a global effort, was that you reduce those costs. And we compared the two. And on the presumptions in the modelling, there were significant costs in the early decades of the transition, adding up to a couple of percent GDP. But from the middle of the century, when climate change, if left to do its worst, would cut in more strongly, the benefits increased. If we did that modelling with today's costs, we would come to a very different result, to a result that saw Australian incomes higher by the middle of this century with strong action on climate change than they would be without action.
What's the other important cost apart from much cheaper wind generation since you did your calculations 10 years ago?
Well, a very big one, systematically favouring strong action on climate change, is a fall in the cost of capital.
Can you explain what that means, how that changes things?
Yeah, the interest rates that are generated by borrowing and lending in global interest rate markets are now very low. Historically, for a government to borrow, and that's generally considered to be low-risk borrowing, for most of history since the Industrial Revolution, real interest rates after inflation, 5% or so, they've fluctuated up and down a bit but haven't varied all that much. In the last half dozen years, in all of the developed countries, real interest rates have been approximately zero. Australian governments can now borrow at interest rates for 10 years below the expected rate of inflation.
You're listening to The Economists on ABCRN. We're talking to Professor Ross Garnaut.
So it sounds like what your policy prescription is for the Australian government is they should take advantage of the low cost of capital, low borrowing cost, and plunge money into investments which have a high upfront cost and also a high long-run benefit. And this green technology is one. I mean, I can think of a few others, like possibly higher education, you know, universal preschool, maybe some health research and development. Do you subscribe to all these sorts of priorities in the current climate? No pun intended.
Yes, this environment of low interest rates, lower than we've ever had in history. But when you look at the history of debt right back to the beginning of civilization, we haven't had anything like this before.
Now, if that dramatically changes costs to mean the benefits clearly exceed the costs of action to move toward zero carbon emissions. I'm wondering whether that would be the case if no other country did it.
That depends industry by industry. In the case of electricity, our electricity-using industries will be more competitive the sooner we've got a system that is fueled mainly by sun and wind, turned into baseload power through all of the technologies that are available, pumped hydro storage, batteries.
We do that even if no one else did it.
I think it's a bit of a no-brainer for the electricity sector. We'll have a lower-cost system and a more reliable system as a result, so long as we realise that's the world that we're going to be living in and build the regulatory frameworks, the transmission systems and so on for that world and not for a world that's past. But there are other industries where for the world as a whole it will continue to be more costly to make the transition.
So Ross, final question for you. The world has historically seen much bigger swings in temperature and climate than what we've seen in the Anthropocene period, that is the period when humans have been around. Do you think this should alter the way that we respond to the projections of climate change today?
Well, the world's got a lot of very good, very clever atmospheric physicists who've spent their lives studying these matters, and they've learnt a lot and they've taught us a lot and they publish about it, and they're all of clear mind that the experiment that humanity is conducting, throwing carbon dioxide and methane pollution into the atmosphere, involves change in the chemistry of the atmosphere more rapidly than certainly earlier in the history of our species. We know from lots of other shocks in human history that when a society takes a shock well outside the norm in severity, then things fall apart. We don't want to take that risk. Sure, there have been times when this planet's been hotter, but those times didn't include times of civilization of our kind.
Ross Garnaut, the man who led the most comprehensive review of the costs and benefits of action on climate change. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thanks very much, Ross. Ross Garnaut has joined us. He's a professorial fellow at Melbourne University and the author of the Garnaut Climate Change Review. And that's The Economist for this week. We'll put a link to Ross Garnaut's new book, Superpower, Australia's Low Carbon Opportunity, together with Deloitte Access Economics, The Path to Prosperity, Why the Future of Work is Human, on our website. That's The Economist at ABC Radio National. That's also where you can send us comments or questions. Just click on Contact Us.
It's also where you can listen to this program and all the others again, as well as via The Economist on the ABC Listen app or your podcast app of choice. Next week, Gigi, we'll have numbers, real numbers, from the Reserve Bank and from the Treasury on the damage done and their forecasts of how we're going to get out of this. We'll no longer be like Bruce Springsteen, dancing in the dark. See you then.